Hi, guys. We are so excited to tell you about our sponsor today. Maltanon Movies is being brought to you by Legion M, and it's the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They are some of the nicest people, and they do lots of really cool things like fan meetups, events all over the country. They really make it fun for anybody who's a part of the Legion.
You can actually own a piece of a movie, and it doesn't cost a fortune to do it. Find out more at www.legionm.com. Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you were listening to Maltin on Movies. And with us today is a fellow who's made a bit of a splash.
Small one.
Yeah, this past year. Made the splash of the year, I would say, in many ways.
The last couple of years.
Yeah, yeah. But this year, golden. Because this is the man who brought Wakanda to the screen and made Black Panther more than a movie, more like a cultural event, a sociocultural event. Enough talk, enough of the, all I said. Hello, Ryan Coogler.
What's going on, Mr. Maltin?
Professor Maltin.
Professor Maltin.
Professor Maltin.
Thank you. And Ms. Maltin.
Yes, yes, sir. Yes, hello. We're
you don't
so
have
happy.
You don't have to call me professor. Ryan was, in fact, in my class, and so were you, Zinti? No.
She came to visit. She came to visit maybe a few times. Yeah. She came to visit maybe a few times. I'm gonna drag her to a few screenings.
Mm-hmm.
But it's incredible. Always, you don't know. You don't ever know who can take off, because nothing is cut and dry like that. You have no clue. So the fact that the three movies that you've made have been three movies that have been huge for people. I like Black Panther, but I really like your other two. And that's the thing is I'm thrilled for anybody. My hope always is if someone sees Black Panther, they're going to go, oh, I wonder what else he's done.
Mm.
And then they're going to look at Creed and Fruitvale.
Mm.
And Fruitvale, it's such a powerful movie. And it was really fun. Fun is the wrong word for Fruitvale, but it was really fun to sort of see you out and about with that movie. And with Michael B. Jordan, who I don't know if he wants to be my best friend, but I would really like that if you want to put a word for me on that one.
I'll talk to him.
Thank you. Thank you. Like,
but also the other story, and the, I think a really valid and interesting story, is how you've kept the same crew around you. You've surrounded yourself with largely classmates.
Yeah, a lot of folks I went to USC with. Mm-hmm. I've been blessed to be able to continue to work with. Michael Shaver is one of them who I worked with a lot since SC. Claudia Costello, you know, worked on all three films. I think Ludwig Göransson worked on all three films.
That's your composer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that you know, a lot of the folks that I met. As she had a, you know, and worked with and got to know had a profound impact on me. But it also helps that they're really talented. You know what I mean? I
think
each time they were all the best people for the, you know, for the job.
Sure. But well, you're not gonna hire, when you're making a real film, you're not gonna hire someone just out of sentimental.
No.
Unless they're family, and then everyone's stuck.
Yeah, not even
a cousin.
Not even family, yeah. No. Family's got to be right, too, you know, or else it go real bad. You know, I'm sure you guys can attest to that.
Yeah, right.
Seem like y'all got a good rhythm here. You know, if it didn't work, you know what I mean? I don't think y'all would do it.
Well, I mean, we fight in the car, you know, we fist fight in the car, and then we get in here and everything's fine.
Yeah.
You know? It's good. It works.
Oh, my God.
Now, how did you wind up at USC?
Oh, wow, that's a good question.
And for those of you who don't live in California, I'm speaking about the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts. If you're back like in the Carolinas, you know, you're talking about a different school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I wound up at USC for graduate school, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I started undergrad at a school called St. Mary's College. Now I was playing football there.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up dropping their program, so I had to go to another place where I could get a scholarship, and I was at Sacramento State. But before I left St. Mary's, I had a teacher recommend that I get into writing screenplays. So you know, I kind of took her advice. She and I stayed close. I went to Sacramento State, finished up playing football there. But while I was there, I took a bunch of filmmaking classes. You know, they had like a small department where you could take, you know, film theory and then film production. And the guy who who taught film production, taught literally all the classes. He taught Pro Tools, he taught cinematography, he taught television studio, you know, and then he taught a class where you would go out and, you know, rent equipment and make your own little short. And he and I became close. And one day, you know, we were talking in office hours and I asked him, you know, where do you learn how to do all of this stuff, this big wide variety of stuff? And he said he went to graduate school at USC and got an MFA. And he said if I was interested in that, you know, after I got done with undergrad, you know, I could apply and maybe do the same. So that was what I did. That was the only film school that I really knew of, you know, and that was the only one that I applied to. And it was really just because of the relationship with this teacher.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Boy, one teacher can make such a difference in your life.
Yeah, for me it was a lot. You know, it was usually one or two teachers at each institution that I was at,
mm-hmm,
that kind of put me on the path that I ended up being on. You know, it was Rosemary Graham at St. Mary's, and then when I got to Sac State, it was Dr. Roberto Pomo, and then Professor Stephen Buss, who was this guy who was an alum of USC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when I got to graduate school, it was, you know, quite a few teachers there that had an impact. One being yourself.
Well, that's incredibly flattering. Thank you very much. So you weren't the guy in the 10th row sleeping. Because I look out at this class, it's an auditorium that seats 350. And at one point, they had the whole football squad in there. And they sat
back
as
row.
Far back as they could.
Back row.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But it's lovely to be able to say that you were in my class. It gives me bragging rights.
Oh,
thank
right.
you for that.
but that's a huge part of it, is I think for – probably true for any film school, but USC especially, because they're so supportive of the alumni and they really fight for the alumni. So whenever anybody gets to bring a film back, whether they took the class while my dad was teaching or in the legacy years,
right,
like, it's a huge deal to get to come back to the school and go, here's my movie.
Yeah.
I did this thing. This is mine. And again, it's crazy because that's how we saw Fruitvale Station.
Ah.
We were at class,
you
know, and you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
with a whole bunch of your colleagues.
Oh my God, it was
probably all of us. Yeah.
It was a party that night. Yeah. Again, whenever we get USC alumni coming through, there's like 30 people in the audience just standing there going, I lived in a room next to him.
Oh man.
I was there.
Yeah, you know, it's nice, man. It's always nice to be able to come back. And you talking about Norris Theater. And I was, you know, I remember when I found out that I had gotten accepted to school, you know, one of the first things I did was, you know, was go there with my wife. She was, man, we weren't even engaged back then. She was just my girlfriend back then. But we went and walked around the campus, you know, and just looked at all of the buildings. And it's a beautiful campus, you know. And but you know, you get to Norris Theater, and it's like, oh man, like maybe one day, you know, maybe one day I'll make a short that'll screen, you know, in this theater, you know. And that was like the goal back then, you know. And then. To be fortunate enough to you know, make a feature film and you know, work with people from that you met in school, you know, we have producers on that film that are off to doing bigger and better things now, like Gerard McMurray and Sevak Ohanian, you know, and to make something with all the folks you met at the school and you know, off campus and away from it in a feature film that's kind of like in a professional world, and then be able to bring it back to students that, you know, doing the same thing we were doing, you know, two or three years before. You know, it's so rewarding, you know.
All three of the films have been there.
For the students, it's such validation.
Yeah.
And inspiration, too. It's like, oh, he did it.
You did the thing. You went to film school and then you made a movie that other people saw, not at the film school. It's a big deal. But we had all three films.
Mm-hmm.
When Creed came down, Sylvester Stallone came with it, which was insane because it's Sylvester Stallone and I was dying. And then Black Panther and Kevin Feige, who always brings the movies. Kevin brings every single.
That was the time that Kevin bowed out deliberately.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Sorry, that's right.
And had your line producer, is
it was Nate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Nate. It was Nate that came. Yeah.
And your screenwriter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So no pressure, but all your films for the rest of time.
Oh man.
Must come to class.
Oh man.
It's a big deal. It is, though. It's very inspirational for them every time that happens.
It's nice, man. It's nice. It's nice to see you guys. And it's also just good to be reminded. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Of where you came from in a way, and also like why you're doing it. You were doing it for such different reasons then. You know what I mean? And circumstances were so different. You know, like I'm older now, a lot more responsibilities. It's a lot more noise.
Yeah.
You know, like back then it was still noise, but it was also just, you know, we were just doing it for the love of the art form. Mm-hmm. You know, and like trying to find a way, trying to get somebody to listen to us. You know what I mean? And now it's a little different, you know.
So how do you keep perspective then? What's your rudder that keeps you on the, you know, is it your wife?
A badass is what you do. Yeah. You marry a badass.
Yeah, that's the rudder right there in the corner.
And you hold on.
Yeah, that's the rudder.
And keep her happy.
Yeah, that's the game plan. You know, but no, I absolutely, man. Like, I've been fortunate to I married the best friend I ever had, you know, mm-hmm. and I had her for a long time, you know, and I have a really big family that's supportive, you know. I've been fortunate enough to take them with me on various projects. You know, my younger brother Keenan, youngest brother I should say, Keenan. I'm the eldest. I got two little brothers, mm-hmm. but my youngest brother Keenan has worked with me in an official capacity for the last, you know, 5 years or so. He was my assistant on Creed and and he's my assistant on Black Panther. I can't afford him anymore. He's writing now, you know. So he's since moved on. But even when we went to Atlanta, because that project was really tough. My middle brother Noah, who makes music under the alias White Dave, he came to Atlanta, you know, for the connections in music down there. But you know, when I looked up, I had my wife with me. I had my brother and both my brothers with me. You know what I mean? As a support system.
Yeah.
And it's helpful, man, because they'll tell me if something sucks. You know what I mean? They'll tell me if I'm acting like an asshole. You know, and you know, it's really good to have that perspective. You know.
Oh sure, because we know it's not a cliche. Some people do surround themselves with yes men, or I should say yes persons. Right. It doesn't
help anybody.
Yeah,
no.
That kind of doesn't help.
No.
That kind of insularity, you know, wall yourself off from the real world.
Yeah, what you're talking about is honesty. You want people
honesty,
who can be honest with you
and trust.
Yeah. You want people who you can trust are gonna be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a difference between telling somebody the truth and telling somebody what you think they want to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, and that. That's a real thing, you know what I mean? Like the more success that you have in anything, you know, the more your chances are of people being less honest with you, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that can be difficult to navigate, I think, for a lot of folks, you know. So I've tried to work with people that have a lot of integrity, you know, and bring my loved ones with me as best I can. And I got really, really smart. You know, loved ones. My brother is really, really sharp kid, man. You know, my wife's really sharp. You know, so it helps that not only do they have my back, but they, you know, they know what they're doing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was the only reason my dad had the career that he had really is because he married my mom, mm. and she's the boss, and she's the business, and she's got the business brain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to.
It started with supportive parents.
Yeah.
Right.
I started writing and publishing myself when I was young, really young.
Right.
And they
he
were
began
behind
the
me.
Nerd dream early.
Yes,
that's amazing.
The nerd
and
dream.
They weren't movie buffs or anything.
Well, how old were you when you purchased your, when you published your first thing? And what was it?
13. I got published for the first time at the age of 13.
I'm telling you, no. In my house, the running joke is that I knew I was a failure at like 12. I was
oh
set.
Oh my God!
I did not have to worry about anything.
13. What publication?
These are what we used to call fanzines.
Okay.
Amateur magazines. In all areas,
I will send you some because we still have boxes in our garage.
There were, you know, Tarzan fanzines, mm-hmm. Edgar Rice Burroughs, and a lot of film buff fanzines. And when I found out about these two particular ones, one in Vancouver and one in Indiana, Pennsylvania, I cold submitted articles to both of them.
Do you understand my life, though? Does it make more sense now?
And they liked them and published them. And then I told them I was 13, and they said they didn't care.
And then at 15, the guy who was running Film Fan Monthly said, I'm going into college. I can't do it anymore. You want it. So then he took over 15. And was publishing Film Fan Monthly. And then at 17, his English teacher said, I want you to meet a publisher friend of mine. Teachers are magic. I want you to meet a publisher friend of mine. He goes in. That's how the movie guide was created. At 18 was the first movie guide.
Oh, my God.
And so, I live under a rock at this point.
Oh, my God.
Because it's nuts. It's nuts. But marrying my mom, the business-minded person.
Right.
Best thing I ever did.
She's the one who makes that part of the work.
It's a running theme I've noticed, like in a lot of industries, man. Like I'm in the film industry, so that's the one that I know the most intimately. But it's like, a lot of people who have careers that seem just like very consistent, impressive, a lot of times you meet their wives and it's like, oh, okay, got it, or their husbands sometimes, and it's like, it's like, okay, it makes sense,
But look at RBG. You're probably too busy, but have you, the RBG?
Nah, I haven't checked, man. I almost played it in the hotel last night, man. I was looking, I was sleepy.
Yeah.
So I was like, RBG upgrade.
Yeah.
And then upgrade went out, man. I feel bad, but I want to watch RBG like when I'm fully alert.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? After a cup of coffee.
But part of what's so inspiring with RBG is her husband was willing to cook and clean and stay home with the kids and did it with pride. Like, that's the thing. It wasn't like, woe is me, my wife's off being amazing, I'm just at home. No, he did that.
I mean, life is a team sport.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it is, man. Like, anybody who doesn't think that is...
Not going far.
Nah, I mean, I haven't seen it yet. You know what I mean?
Like,
it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
It makes sense that for her to have... that kind of consistency and tenacity in our professional life. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like it's gotta be some kind of support system.
Yeah.
There, and a consistent support system. Mm-hmm. That makes me even more excited to watch this, man.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to make you go through the whole story, but maybe you can tell us in brief, how did you meet up with Forrest Whitaker?
Oh yeah, it's relatively brief. Like, I was in film school. This would have been 2011 ish, like spring semester 2011. That's when I came out of school. But I came into class one day, and one of my professors was like, "Hey, yo, do you like Forrest Whitaker?" And I was like, "Of course." They're like, "Yeah, it's a woman who's running his production company who wants to meet with young film students," and I recommended you. Would you be down and go meet with her? And I was like, yeah, no question. So yeah, so the woman's name who ran Forrest Production Company is Nina Yang, and her contact at USC was a woman named Jane Kagan. Mm-hmm. I didn't know Jane so well. We had probably crossed paths in passing at the school, but I actually my professor Jed Denenbaum was very close with Jane, and she asked Jed. Knowing that he taught 507 and kind of came in contact with a lot of filmmakers, if it was anybody who she could recommend to Nina, and my name came up, I actually my last semester of school, I had this meeting arranged with Nina Yang, and I was really excited. Hadn't had any professional meetings like that before. Didn't really know what to expect. Was kind of pessimistic, as far as the industry goes. Because we would have, agents would come to the school sometimes, and they'll be kind of negative. They'll say, "Yo, none of you guys are gonna ever direct. Nobody's ever gonna get an agent. That kind of thing." So I was like, "No, I don't know what's gonna happen." I'll meet her, I'll say hello, and she'll probably say, "Nice to see you," and send me on my way. But I went to her office. It was on the Disney lot, oddly enough, in the animation building, and I remember being real nervous, not really knowing what to wear. And going in and sitting with her. She's a real, really, really nice lady. She was younger than I expected. And I remember her just kind of talking about the company. It was called Significant Production Productions, and you know, talking about Forrest and how she got to kind of work with Forrest, how she came out of the music industry first, you know, and then she was like, hey, you know, do you have any ideas, like any screenplays you're working on, anything like that? And I was like, wait, what, I'm pitching now? Right. Like, what's happening? You know, and I told her about a few things that I had been, you know, that I've been writing. Fruitvale was one of them. And she was like, okay, you know, like, get them together. And, you know, she said, get them together, send me some of your short films. We'll watch these, you know, and then we'll, you know, we'll get back to you, you know, if you think, you know, it'd be good for you to come in and talk to Forrest. And like, I think a few weeks later, you know, she emailed me, was like, hey, yo, Forrest has time. He wants to meet with you. You know, he looked at your short films. You know, he said he'd love to hear about some of your ideas. So then at that point, I think I put on a shirt and tie, and I went in, and I met Forrest. That was the story of how we met. You know, I pitched him Fruitvale that day. I pitched him a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. Fruitvale was one of them, but I made it clear to him that Fruitvale was the one that I was gonna do no matter what. You know, and he was like, yeah, let's do it. You know, like and he just kind of walked out. You know, and Nina was, you know, Nina was like, I really excited, and then you know, and then from there we ended up deciding to work on that film together, you know, but this was like right as I was getting ready to graduate.
Man, and that only happened because you had gotten this, or almost inadvertently, I think, gotten this job organizing and transcribing the tapes,
yeah,
videos, the testimony.
You would have, that was different. So I had another classmate who was actually in the law school, mm-hmm. but he was from Oakland. His name was Ephraim Walker, and he started to take film production classes, you know, as a law student. I think it was called the Gould School of Law, I think it is, at SC. And we actually met on a plane ride from LA to Oakland. You know, we were like, it was like Southwest, you know, you lining up.
Yeah.
And I saw this other black dude, and he was like the only two black people on the flight. And we kind of were looking
going
at each
other. Going to Oakland?
Yeah. We were kind of looking at each other. And he was kind of looking, I'm kind of looking back, and I'm like, hey, man, what's up? He's like, what's up? And then eventually we start talking. And Ephraim, I don't know if you ever met him, he's always got this big smile on his face. You know, just an overly positive guy. And so we ended up talking, and found out we knew a lot of people in common. He's a little older than I am, but we're from the same, you know, area roughly. Mm-hmm. And he ended up taking a job once he graduated from law school with John Burris, who is the civil rights attorney in the Bay Area, who deals with a lot of cases with police officers violate human rights, you know. So he's working in his office. And I mentioned to Ephraim that I would like to make a film about Oscar Grant. So when the case kind of came across his desk while he was there, he said, hey, Ryan, you know, I'm here working with the family. I'm working with the lawyer. If you still want to do that, you know, I can make an introduction, you know. So this was kind of happening simultaneous to what happened with Nina.
Man.
You know, and then once I had that meeting with Forrest, I called Ephraim and I was like, hey, man, I got to form an outline because I think I got to get some paperwork to him before he changes his mind,
right.
You know. And then Ephraim at that point started to give me all of, like, the public record stuff that was legal for, mm-hmm. that was like out there and legal to, for me to get sure, my hands sure. on. Uh-huh. He started to share that stuff with me, like, you know, show me how to get access to it. So I started to build the outline for the screenplay from all those documents and video and stuff like that.
Incredible!
Wow.
Serendipity, man. That's
yeah.
That's really something.
You can't plan or chart something
no.
like that.
No.
So no. Was little Ryan into making movies?
I was not. Yeah, I was into watching them, and it was just because my mom loved watching them so much, and my dad did too. Even though, like, he would tell you my mom was the movie person, but my dad watched a lot of sports movies and action movies, like a ton of Steven Seagal, mm-hmm. you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme. You know, he was in anything action or athletic. You know,
right.
And obviously he loved the Rocky films.
Sure.
My mom was like was you know, when I look back on it, she was like she was a cinephile, you know, mm-hmm. like had just it's impeccable taste, you know, and also like followed certain filmmakers, you know, and would want to share it with me, you know what I mean? I remember like one of my fondest memories of my parents was when I was young, and they went on a date to see The Fugitive, mm-hmm. and this is when we were still living in Oakland, this neighborhood called Bushrod. And I think I might have been watching my little brothers, or we might have had a babysitter. I'm not sure. But they came home, and my mom was so excited that, like, you know, I was sitting on the couch, and she, like, basically, like, acted out the whole movie from you know, like, from start to finish. You know what I'm saying? It was like, she's like, Ryan, I can't wait to show you this movie. Like, you know, when it we didn't have I don't think we had a VHS just yet.
Got to dream big.
So she was like, man, when it comes, we're gonna get a VCR, like, you know, so we can watch this movie when it comes out. We're gonna watch it, you know. And she was telling me about this scene when the train, like, felt like it was gonna drive into the crowd, you know. And I remember when it came out, what's crazy is when it came out, she ran to Blockbuster and rented it. And we popped it in, you know what I'm saying? And she was like so excited. And then the first thing came on was like the warning. Like, this picture has been modified to fit your screen. And she lost it because she thought that they meant that they cut out the train scene. Yeah. She was like, oh my God, this is so ridiculous. Like, I'm gonna call Blockbuster. Like, it took out the train scene, I know it.
Oh my God.
You know what I mean? I'm like, Mom, just sit down and chill. Like, you know, we'll watch it, we'll see what they change. I don't think they would have taken that out. And she's like, no, I know they did. You know, like, it's too big for the
TV. She's burning down the Blockbuster. Yeah. She's like, how dare you?
Yeah, but she would do a lot, man. Like, she had she worked at a nonprofit, you know, and kind of ran the books for that. And it was at a time when it was growing pretty rapidly, you know. So she had, you know, real busy job. She'd come home, cook dinner for everybody, you know what I'm saying? Take care of us, take care of my pops, you know. Her mind would kind of still be going. Like, so it was hard for her to sleep. Mm. So she would put movies on. You know what I mean? To help her go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And her go-tos were you know, gangster movies. So it'd be like, you know, like De Palma's Untouchables, she would watch a lot, and mm-hmm. then Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. You know, like it was just like on you know, constantly, like, you know, my mom falling asleep to Goodfellas. You know what I mean? So, like, as a kid, you know, like, I know this movie by heart from hearing it through the walls. You know what I mean? You know, like I'm a funny guy. I know that whole movie start to finish.
Yeah.
So looking back, it's like, no, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't know I wanted to make movies, but I had, you know, I had just hours and hours of exposure to them. And then as a family, that was what we would do. You know, we would mm-hmm. go to the movies, or if I had to babysit my brothers, we would rent a movie and mm-hmm. you know, so.
Well, that's, you know, so many people across generations have bonded over movies.
Yeah.
And it's one of the, one of the most notable things about Black Panther and its success is that it literally brought people together.
Mm.
It transcended just being a movie, even it transcended being a hit movie. It really gave people a sense of community, a sense of pride, a sense of belonging, a sense of a world maybe larger than their own. But you're so smart because you rooted it in your hometown of Oakland and took off from there. But now people, I think of Wakanda as real.
Oh, yeah. I don't think they know it's not a thing.
You made it.
I'm pretty sure they're
You made it so real, Ryan.
They should make it. And Disney has, like, Castaway Key, and that they should make a Wakanda. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they're doing it already at Disney World. There's going to be a Wakanda. Mm. But you should make it.
That's kind of you guys to say that, man. Like I think that I mean, the value of myth, you know, can't be understated. Mm. You know what I mean? It just can't. And so many things, you know, when you're talking about things that are like outside of the present, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So many things are mythical, even things that existed, you know what I mean, become myth. Like, I think about, you know, where my wife and I are from, you know, Oakland. You know, the Oakland that we're from doesn't exist anymore. You know what I mean? Like, due to things that happen with time, you know what I'm saying? Like mm-hmm. The economy, gentrification, mm-hmm. you know, buildings going up and coming down, you know what I mean? But that place that when we say, yo, we from Oakland, we talking about a very specific time, you know what I mean? And it doesn't exist anymore. And it's almost become like a mythical thing, you know? And you know, the thing is that, you know, Wakanda, you know, is just as real, you know, like textually, you know what I'm saying, as that place was. If you want to really talk about it, because mm-hmm. you can't point to that place where we're from anymore.
Right.
Like, I could show you pictures of it. You know what I mean? I could tell you a little bit about, you know, what happened, but you know, for the all of the physical qualities of it, it's gone. You know.
Yeah.
And so I think that's. Like myth, sometimes it's just as powerful as history, you know, and sometimes more, if not more so.
Yeah.
Well, that's so. My parents are New Yorkers. My mom says all the time, the New York I grew up in is not there anymore, and it's very much that. It's exactly what you're talking about. That feeling of, you know, when they go back, they laugh when they see that Brooklyn or any of these are trendy or popular. My mom's from the Bronx, and she mm-hmm. said, when you were born in the Bronx, the goal was to leave the Bronx.
Right.
Her father's goal in life was to leave the Bronx. Right. And now people are going, oh, it's terribly, terribly trendy.
Right.
And then they, you know, it's right. it's a crazy thing to try to look back and right. figure it all out.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, a lot of this process was, you know, and I talked to other creatives about this. Man, I actually like to talk to Ta-Nehisi a lot about this because Ta-Nehisi Coates has become a friend over the past few years, and our relationship started with the fact that we were both working on this character and working on this concept, you know, in two different mediums. You know, he kind of beat me to it, you know, in the original medium, the comic book medium,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I had a conversation with him, you know, he didn't hide like why he was doing it, you know what I mean? He was even writing the publications about why he was taking the project on when he was writing for the Atlantic, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, and a lot of the value and the ideas of myth and identity, you know, were there. You know what I mean? And you know, we tell each other stories about our history, and it helps to form, you know, it kind of helps to form who we are.
Yeah.
And for African Americans, and I think Africans in the diaspora, you know, and even Africans on the continent, because colonization doesn't just attack you physically, you know, it also attacks your mind, and it attacks your myths, and it attacks your self-image.
Sure,
your self-image.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah, and it also spoon feeds, almost force feeds you myths of other from other cultures, so that you know those myths almost better than you know your own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I could tell you about, you know, Johnny Appleseed or Paul Bunyan,
mm-hmm.
or Thor or Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
Way better in more detail than I can tell you about any African deities. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and so that is, it's a problem in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and that issue was something that Wakanda and our job as creatives in building stories around it. That issue is something we were trying to unlock, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the. From Fruitvale to Creed to the Wakanda takeover of universe, it's the thing that I find so interesting is that in each one, it's the story. And why it works is the story. And I think a huge part of why Black Panther had the reaction it is because things felt real. If mm-hmm. everything feels fake, if everything feels CG, mm-hmm. then you can't really connect to it.
Right.
I would say one of my biggest problems with things like Spider-Man is that it doesn't look like a human is swinging. And while I realize right. you can't really like shove someone off a building,
right.
part of me kind of wants you to.
Right.
Not for death, but just like right. like part of me needs, in the same way that if right. you have fights that are too CG,
right.
then you don't have a horse in the race.
Right.
Like it has to look like someone's fighting.
Right.
Otherwise, you don't actually feel like anyone's fighting.
Right.
So to me, to watch your progression where you have Fruitvale, which is all story,
right.
in a sense, very little theatrics
right.
in that one's case.
Right.
And then you move to Creed, where you get into not only a story that people are diehard. Rocky is on, you know.
Well, that's become mythic, hasn't
it? It's huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah, it always was. You know, like, it always was. I talk to Stallone about it all the time, and he always...
Just say that one more time and enjoy it.
No,
talk to Stallone.
Yeah, I would talk to Stallone about that all the time. And he would, you know, and boxing is, you know, he saw the myth in it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like he saw the myth in it. That was kind of why, if you watch Rocky, the first thing, you know, you think about the first one, right? And you think about what you think about. You think about the first one. Is you think about it in context with all of it that came after it, you know, and compared to all the ones that came after it, it's very down to earth. It feels like an indie '70s, you know, working class, drama. You know what I mean? But when you really think about what's the first frame of Rocky? The first frame of Rocky is giant block letters scrolling across the screen, right to the left, mm-hmm. with Trump is blaring. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like Mount Olympus, like, you know what I'm saying? You know, it's telling you that, you know, you're going to watch something larger than life. You're going to watch a myth, you know what I mean? And then you cut to, you know, this guy walking down the streets of Philadelphia. But, you know, in his mind, you know, the myth was always there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's David and Goliath. You know, it's all of these things. You know, put into a context of the times. You know, but yeah, you're right. Rocky does have that mythical.
It is. It's to me like it's the middle. It really is the middle between the films that you've made, where it starts to get into that. Oh, this is more than just reality.
Right.
And of course, all the stories of how you made Creed are fascinating. It is, because to put in a new chapter for something that is beloved and already had 17 sequel. I don't even know how to. What are we, like Rocky 8?
Yeah.
You know.
Yep. Yeah, the 8th one now.
That was a total guess. Good job, mate.
No, yeah, it's about to come out in a few days.
Yeah,
all of the guys that gearing up to guys and gals, gearing up to go to the East Coast for the premiere. Tessa and Mike and Capel, Stephen Capel, who also went to USC, who directed the second one.
Oh man,
you know, yeah, it's exciting.
How hands on were you with the sequel?
Not hands on at all. Like you know what I was at a comfortable distance. I would say you know I happen to know Capel. So was so excited when the prospects of him directing came up and was supportive there. And I, you know, and obviously I'm a friend, you know, Mike and I are close, you know, and you know, Stallone and I are close. So I was there, you know, because I was there for them when they needed me, you know what I mean? And I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to be too present because Steven is so talented and capable, you know what I mean? And I think he really proves with this film, you know, just how awesome of a filmmaker he is. You know, so I kept a comfortable distance, I'll say. You know, and I was, you know, obviously busy finishing up Panther because they both kind of were going around the same time.
Yeah.
You know, but I couldn't be happier with the film that they've made.
That's great.
Stallone's performance in Creed is so good. He won't allow you to compliment him, I learned. When he was at class, I met him and about died, but went over and I said, this is such a good performance. Because again, a lot of people don't realize how much he had to do with Rocky in terms of writing and putting it all together. A lot of people are not aware of that part of it.
Right.
That he is why the movie's the movie.
Right.
So to see him do this and be so good, but it was what I said to him, like, this is so great. You're so good in this. People get to really see your acting. And he just, no.
Yeah. No. He's a really talented guy, man.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, I think that it's also like, you know, I think that, you know, you've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's like you, Leonard, like when you talk about being a professional writer since you were 13, like when you sit down and write, you know what I mean? Like it's you know what you're doing. You know, and it's that kind of thing with Stallone. He's been like he knows what he's doing. Like he puts that hat on and that coat and he makes it look like the best thing that somebody who's really good can do is make it look easy.
Right.
You know,
and
that's what he does. He makes things that are incredibly difficult, like, totally effortless.
Which is why he's often not valued.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you make it look too easy, people don't see it.
Yeah. People don't appreciate it.
But we know this is true with so many members of crew, whether it's a costume designer, a wardrobe person, where you just have to look, again, Fruitvale, they just have to look normal. Mm-hmm. They just have to look regular. Mm-hmm. So
a lot of work goes into
exactly
that.
To make something look like because obviously then you get something again like Black Panther where it's a whole other situation.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, I'm fascinated by the way you cast. Like, look what you did. You've got Michael B. Jordan, and then you got Tessa Thompson, who has blown up in such a crazy way. And then that's that story too with Creed. The fact that it's your wife, how you put that in for her character.
Oh, right, right. The hearing loss.
Yeah.
I think everybody makes movies as personal as they can. It's interesting. I was just at a Lacrimal event the other night. They were honoring Catherine Opie and Guillermo del Toro, and start off with Catherine, who's this amazing photographer who I was like ashamed that I hadn't heard of yet. Because her work was so moving to me, and Zinzi as well. And they showed a little retrospective of her work, and she got up and spoke, and I was like, man, that's amazing. And I was in my mind, I was like, man, Guillermo's got to go after that. You know what I'm saying? I was just kind of thinking that, because I've seen all of Guillermo's movies, and then they came out, I think Katzenberg came out and introed him. And then they showed a beautifully edited supercut of Guillermo's work. And what they were showing was the same way they approached the film about Catherine. And even though Catherine spoke in her film, Guillermo, his images from his films kind of spoke for it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the supercut, they were just juxtaposing how almost all his movies had like the same setups, like the same kind of production design, the same kind of locations, like the same kind of story happening, And I was like, oh my God, like this dude's been making he's been getting things that have been in him all along. He keeps getting them out in different ways, And I've seen some of his films where I could see, I think probably the easiest. Meal there is probably, you can make some direct correlations between Shape of Water, Pan's Labyrinth, and maybe even Hellboy a little bit.
Oh, definitely.
Like where it's a character who belongs here but comes up there for whatever reason and has to return. But I'm looking at all his work. From Kronos to Crimson Peak, mm-hmm. and some of the shots, they were blending them together so well. I'm like, wait, which movie is that? You talking about movies that were like, mimic. You talking about stuff that's like decades apart, it's absolutely the case that as a filmmaker, man, you have almost a responsibility to bring yourself to the material,
mm-hmm.
And he got up and spoke, and gave a beautiful speech, man.
He is so eloquent.
Oh my God!
When he talks about
it's his second language.
I get
depressed. You know what I mean? Like when that happens, I'm like, I can't get on the podium without stuttering and bumbling. You know what I'm saying? And I know one language. Just to hear this dude, second language. You know what I'm saying? Speaking of things in our time that you just can't not listen to, no matter what side of anything you sit on. And what I realized made it so powerful is that what he was saying, he had already said with his movies.
Mm-hmm.
He had said like that this super eloquent speech. He didn't have to say, because if you look at his at what he's been putting, mm-hmm.
It's all there.
And that part of it is why I'm so honored and blessed and thankful to be able to work in this field. Because you get to do that, you get to bring a little piece of yourself to a story, and put it in, and not know if it's going to work or connect. You know what I mean? And then sometimes it does.
Yeah, talk about my future best friend, Michael B. Jordan.
I was just with him yesterday, at the HFA. It's always good to see him. He's really he's a good dude. Super, super talented and gifted, very motivated. I think he loves the industry as well.
Mm.
Doesn't get like a lot of credit for how sharp of a businessman he is.
Mm-hmm.
And also somebody who makes hard stuff look easy. Also somebody who's been doing it since he was very young. Mm-hmm. I think he started acting professionally when he was like 9 years old.
Mm.
So all he's done since then. Yeah, like a lot of similarities. You, Leonard, got going early. You know, but no, like, you know, I can't speak highly enough of him, and I think there are people really going to be blown away by his performance in this next film.
There's a moment in Creed that just blows me away, and I got to ask him about it at the LA Film Critics Awards dinner. It's where he's walking along the sidewalk with Stallone, and suddenly, out of nowhere, it just goes into the Marlon Brando Godfather voice. And it's a throwaway.
Yeah.
It's just there. You don't emphasize it. He doesn't overdo it.
Yeah.
But it's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. He's about poking a little fun. Yeah, poking a little fun at Stallone. Yeah, no, I always, yeah, him and Sly had really great chemistry together. And, yeah, and that scene, I remember that scene because we were running out of time. So we had to do it in a one-er. And they were playing catch with Rocky's bounce ball. Mm-hmm. And he takes it from him. And kind of he's trying to convince him to take that fight that happens in the second act with Sperino. Yeah, he tells him, make me an offer. Make him an offer he can't refuse. You know, no, I'll make you an offer that you can't refuse. That's when he says he'll move in with him and start training, you know, around the clock. You know, but no, like it's that part of the film is some of my favorite stuff because it's like in structure, I guess they'll tell you that's like the fun and games part of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you kind of get what, you know, you get an audience what they signed up for, you know what I mean? And they, you mm-hmm. know, you sign up for seeing Rocky train this young kid,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and that's the part when you're seeing that relationship blossom before the touchy, more emotional stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, no, it's really great, really, really great acting there, man. It's a little meta.
Just for a moment. That's fine. I hope this isn't too big a question, but I know you've dealt with it before.
Mm-hmm.
What did it mean to you and your production designer
mm-hmm.
to actually go to Africa?
Because
you had already done a presentation, and she had already done a presentation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. For me, it was a lifelong dream, man, to go to the continent. And I always had a fear that I wouldn't ever make it, you know, which is something I haven't talked about a lot. But you know, it, you know, because you know you're so far away, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't somebody who came up traveling. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like my parents didn't have those kind of means. You know, like it was, you know, they did okay for themselves. You know what I'm saying? And took great care of my brothers and I. But it was like, you know. You know, we were in private school, you know, and that was it. You know what I mean? Like, and when I traveled, it was for a football game or a track meet. You know, and if we went on a vacation, it was like, you know, a few hours drive. You know, I think that we went on one family vacation to Washington D.C. once. You know, and it was like, you know, and it was like a big deal, like big save up. You know what I mean? Cross country trip to go see my grandmother on my father's side before she passed away, but you know the idea of traveling internationally was such a luxury, man. It was a luxury that like nobody really was doing like that we knew, and at the same time, you know, through your heritage that this is the place that you're from, you know, and so many complications with that, you know. So it was a place that I always wanted to go. One day, and it was a place I wanted to take my family one day, you know. And I always felt like I would learn more about myself if I had the opportunity. But deep down, I had a fear that I wouldn't get to go. You know, I'll die before I got to, you know, before I got to see it. So getting to actually do it and getting to do it on this film, you know, was incredibly meaningful. You know, it's just, you know, and I'll say that, you know, I made three films and, you know, you put a lot of yourself into the films. And I've been fortunate that the films have always given me something back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They've always given me something back personally. And whether it was for Fruitvale, it was a desire to have children. You know, like when I first started to make that film, I didn't know if I wanted kids or not. You know, and it was like it happened, like literally on you know, while I was on set thinking about the film, and I was like, y'all want. you know, y'all want kids, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, in the film, you know, gave me that as well as, you know, giving me a career, you know, with Creed, you know, Creed gave me, gave me a lot as well. Taught me a lot about myself as a filmmaker, as a person, you know. I think I came out of that film understanding my father a little bit better, you know. You know, but none of the films have given me as much as Panther has, you know, and just taking me to the continent, you know what I mean?
But what you managed to do, you were saying that every filmmaker makes his or her film personal in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that's true, although there are people who just do sort of work for hire sometimes, mm-hmm. where they're, you know,
mm-hmm.
doing the job.
Mm-hmm.
But you do more than do the job. Mm-hmm. You really do give us a personal path. And whether we're totally conscious of it or not, it gives us something back. And in the case of your three films, something very resonant.
Oh, I appreciate that.
And the evidence is everywhere. The evidence is everywhere.
Have you seen the memes of Chadwick Boseman from the beginning to now with doing the
Wakanda Forever? Oh, yeah. I have. Those are hilarious, man.
Bless his heart.
Yeah.
Everybody wants him to do the Wakanda Forever cross thing. And there's this progression of images where it's him at the beginning like, yeah, Wakanda Forever. And then there's him now
he's
like,
just dead on his feet.
Stop asking. Yeah. And when Michael B. Jordan won an MTV award,
uh-huh.
and part of his acceptance speech was, please stop going up to Chadwick Boseman and asking him to do the damn Wakanda Forever thing, guys.
He had to speak up for his buddy, man.
It was so, I was dying.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it's another thing that symbol, this cross-arm symbol situation, holy crap, it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere.
Oh, man.
You made a thing that went everywhere.
I think we all collectively made it. But we got it from, you know, like, we got it from old African statues, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, mm-hmm. and like looking at imagery of like, you know, like King Tut, you know what I mean? And pharaohs and stuff. So I mean, it's something that people do. And you know, when we first started talking about, you know, Zinzi, my wife, kind of brought it to my attention that this means, you know, this means like I love you.
Yes.
In sign language, you know what I mean? And it's a symbol that's used, you know, like in so many cultures, man, all the time, you know, and you know, I feel like it's just cool that people have taken to it for sure, but you know, I don't think we can take too much credit for it.
It's just, this is the thing.
But it was a choice.
Yeah, if a movie is great, the director gets credit. If a movie is terrible, the director gets credit.
Yeah.
So
or gets blame.
Either way, the whole thing is even. Now, you're, again, I think that you're a smart guy, but you're also someone who appreciates his collaborators. So you can say and want to say, this is where it came from, this is how it started.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, at this point, it comes down to Ryan Coogler did this.
Oh, man.
But what is it? You represent the collective. You represent everyone that's in there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Even all the women, which has been such a huge thing. I saw her at the Spirit Awards this year, and I was knocked out because she's stunning, but she's also just really, she's something.
Regal.
Yeah.
Yeah, she got a nobility to her.
She does.
For sure.
All the women you cast, all of them.
Yeah.
Is what I mean? I'm fascinated by casting, but you've got someone, again, you've got Tessa Thompson in Creed, where Tessa Thompson has blown up, and people are obsessed with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then... With
Melanie and Octavia.
Yes,
and
we love Melanie Diaz. Yeah. We love her.
Yeah, but no, for us, we just hire the best people we can.
Right.
You know, like that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, but there's a step before that. You write great female characters, and you set the bar ridiculously high in Black Panther, with four really powerful women. Other filmmakers and other storytellers coming up behind you have got to now emulate what you've set down.
Oh man!
But
my co-writer Joe Robert Cole and I we would talk about this, you know, often. The fact that, you know, in the comic books leading up to Panther, like the, you know, the graphic novels that it's based off of, you know, you had all these amazing characters that you know, the women. You know, you got Shuri, you got the Dora Milaje, who's you know, it's all female military division. You got Okoye and Nakia, you know, and then you got Shuri, you know, who becomes Black Panther in the books, and has like really amazing relationship with our brother in the books. So we that stuff was there.
Mm.
We had a responsibility to put it on screen, and you know, put it on screen in a way that we felt would be relative to the times. And I think a big thing was for us was like, you know, what makes Wakanda special? That was a question we were always asking, and we felt that if it was just this material that they built their country, you know, on. Then that's not really all that cool. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That just means they hit the lotto and they were born in the right spot. You know
right.
what I'm saying? And that's not truly compelling. You know, it was like, yo, like it has to be more to justice. I think that would be special even if they didn't have this stuff, you know.
Well, there you go back to myth building.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that was the thing where it was like, man, maybe they treat each other in a way that's aspirational. You know what I mean? That we can aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when like gender dynamics in Wakanda was something that we circled with, that saying, man, you know, gender dynamics in Wakanda should feel different. It should feel aspirational, you know. And what are these women like where, you know, they grow up in a place where they're expected to be great. You know what I mean? They're expected to be the greatest versions of themselves. And nothing in society is gonna hold them back from that.
No.
You know? So that was kind of what we were thinking when we were working on the character, you know.
Well, there's also no part of what I appreciate is there's no mention of it in the sense of aren't we great because we've got all these women?
Mm-hmm.
Like there just is female warrior army.
Right.
It just is.
Yeah, we try to drop you off in the ground level.
But that's
yeah.
it. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah,
the,
exactly.
the sister is the only time anything's referenced is she's young.
Right.
And that's fair. You
right.
know, oh, you have a little girl doing this, but it's not, you know, it's not about the girl part. It's that she's young.
Yeah.
I thought that, and it's what
yeah,
I've talked to
she's
a lot
a
of
child.
People.
Yeah, it's not
she's
about
a child,
her being
not, she's
yeah.
a girl.
Yeah.
So the fact that all your characters are incredible.
It's interesting that you say that.
Yeah. And again, going back to the wife, the badass wife, it all makes sense, though.
Yeah.
But it comes together.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no, for sure, man. And it's not, and like I said, it's not just me. I think it's, you know, it's Joe, it's our actresses, because there'll be times where, you know, we try to create an environment where, you know, and we try to hire the type of collaborators that are gonna be honest. You know, like mm-hmm. none of these women that we mentioned, like Melanie, Octavia, Letitia, Lupita, Denai, Angela, you know, Tessa, none of them are gonna read something that doesn't make sense. And then go and say it in front of the camera. They're gonna say, "Hey Ryan, hey Joe, this doesn't make sense yet.
Yeah.
Like, what can we do to get this right?"
Yeah.
You know, and there were times when they did that. You know, like it's not like we just, you know, sat in a room and typed out what you saw on the screen. You know
yeah.
what I mean? It was a process,
and
in that process is hiring the right people. It's creating the right environment where they feel
right.
comfortable to even if we up against the clock and you got, you know, millions of dollars being spent. They feel comfortable enough to walk over to me and say, "Yo, it's not ready yet." You know what I'm saying? Let's get it ready before we
wow.
put this up. And that I would say, you know, I'm just a cog in the machine when it comes to that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you're a talented cog.
I was gonna say.
And we are out of time. And
this was great, though.
We're so glad you could spare us some time today.
Oh, nah, man, it's. This was a good time. It was good to see you guys and get to do this.
We love it. And where do people follow you?
Are you a social media? That's good, England. Are you a social media person?
No.
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 It's a saying. Anytime someone says it, I go, "That's why you're sane." It all makes sense now.
I'm not sane, But no. But yeah, social is definitely not to blame for my insanity. Other things. Like I still own a smartphone, which is, you know, problematic. You know what I'm saying?
That's when you're in demand, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
The dinging is in your nightmares.
Yeah, I hope I'm blessed to make another movie and we can do this again.
Sometime
down the road.
You will make many movies, and we will always be fans.
And we mere mortals can be found where?
You are at Leonard Maltin, and I am at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com. for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
And we thank you for listening. We thank Ryan for being here and his wife, Zinzi, who didn't speak up today, but we still felt your presence. So thank
Queen
you for
of the
being
podcast. Here. Queen of the podcast. Here.
And we will see you all next week. Thanks for listening. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.